Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It. Today I have Jameson Toole of Fritz coming to us from Boston, a morning Boston. How's your day going today, Jameson?
Other than the loss yesterday and a bit of a cold snap, I can't really complain. Sun was out.
For anyone who's not listening to this immediately, yesterday the mighty Patriots were dethroned by the upstart Eagles in the Super Bowl. I have to say it was a little bit gratifying as a Denver Broncos fan to see the Patriots get taken out.
I went to the University of Michigan as an undergrad, and where there was a Michigan defensive player who took out the Michigan offensive player. So I think the university won at the end of the day.
That's a good perspective. Good attitude. Seeing the bright silver lining. Good stuff. Okay, great. Well, thanks for being here today. Let's talk about your business. So what is Fritz and why did you start this company? What do you guys do?
Sure. So Fritz is a tool for developers to help them put machine learning or artificial intelligence models into their app. There's two, really big technological trends that are coming together. The first is all the advances that we're seeing in machine learning and AI, doing things like neural networks for image recognition, voice recognition, that sort of thing. And then all of these real-time user experiences that are powered by them, thanks to the hardware-accelerated AI-specific chips that are going into all of these devices. Now, if you've bought a new iPhone or a new Pixel, they've actually got special chips in them to process just the type of data structures that are behind all of these machine learning algorithms. And what that means is we can actually start taking these neural networks and these models out of the cloud and putting them directly on the devices themselves, where they run a lot faster. It's a lot cheaper for a company because you don't have to run these expensive GPUs in the cloud. And it's a lot more private because you can still get all the benefits of machine learning into your app, but all of the data stays there.
How did you come up with this idea? What were you doing before founding Fritz?
Yeah, so my background is all on the data science machine learning side of things. So as I mentioned, I went to the University of Michigan for undergrad. I did physics and economics there. Came to Boston in 2010 to do my PhD at MIT. And there I combined the two where we would ask economic questions about people's behavior within cities and answer them using machine learning models that were really inspired by physics. So I'm an engineer by trade. After I graduated, I worked at a consumer mobile tech company here in Boston, building and running a data science team for a little over a year. And then, I just had a niche and needed to go off and try to found something myself.
That's cool. When did you start it? How long have you guys been around?
So my co-founder and I started originally about 2 years ago. The first year was spent commercializing some of my PhD work. And that, we did that. It was a lot of fun. But after about a year, we sat down and decided, maybe there's another market that we should go after with higher growth potential. And so really it was last May that, Fritz kind of came into our minds when we started seeing, all of the amazing things that people were building, whether it was, all the features Snapchat was adding around augmented reality or self-driving cars. And then Apple, had a big announcement around a technology they call Core ML, which essentially allows developers to run hardware-accelerated machine learning models directly on any Mac device. Last summer was really the time that we started thinking seriously about these problems, and they were ones that we had solved in the past as developers, and we knew, how painful it was, and we felt there would be a better way.
Okay, before we get into the fundraising, which we'll touch on in a second, are your customers entities like Snapchat and Apple, or like who would buy this?
So if you're building a mobile app and you want to use machine learning, it will be a better user experience if you put those models directly in the device where they can be run in real time. And we have a platform that helps you do that.
Cool. Great, great. So when you launched this, you know, you're commercializing some of your PhD work. That's always really interesting. How did you get it off the ground? Did you fund it yourself? Did you do friends and family round? What was that first, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, the first year, which we spent, was all bootstrapping. So, you know, that work that we had done, you know, the customer was very different. It was sort of a different business. We pivoted, so to speak, away from that. But we did have some revenue from that first business, and we used that to bootstrap the second one. And, you know, it was really about 6 months or so, I would say, of bootstrapping before we were in a place where we felt comfortable raising.
Okay. So how much have you raised total, and in how many rounds?
So we have done one round. It was a formal seed round. We raised $2 million from, you know, institutional investors, and that was closed. Well, we just announced the funding on January 11th.
Oh, great. Congrats. Did you have a lead investor? Was it a price round? Did you have a lead investor, or what was the?
Yep. It was a price round. ENIAC Ventures out of New York. They also have an SF office, led the round. Awesome, awesome guys. And then Uncork Capital, formerly Soft Tech VC out in San Francisco, wrote another long check. And then we had two syndicates fill out the round.
Angelus syndicates or just offline syndicates?
Yeah. Angelus syndicates, yeah.
Interesting. Let's touch on those a minute. We'll kind of jump around, but what were the syndicates? Were they focused on AI, or were they just some prominent angels? And
yeah, so one of them was HackVC, which is by Ed Roman out in SF, and, you know, is a thesis around developer tools, AI, and then there was another angel investor from Boston, which was just, you know, through a network of my co-founder.
Stick on this just for a minute, and then I want to get to your lead investors. With these syndicates, did you already have the lead investors and then go fill out, you know, the last chunk of your round with syndicates, or did they come in earlier?
So this is actually a piece of advice, you know, that I would give people, or it's an opinion. I don't know if it's the best advice. We made a point of not trying to fill out the round until we had a lead investor. So, you know, some people like to go out and try to build some momentum, build some traction with soft commitments. We had tried that with the first business that we started. So we actually went through two separate raise processes, one with the previous business and one with this one. And, you know, in our opinion, you still have to do the same amount of work to get a commitment from, you know, small syndicate without a lead that you do to get the commitment from the big check, and it was just, you know, too much. So with Fritz, you know, we specifically said, let's get a lead investor in place first. We certainly had some conversations with people who didn't lead, but we just politely said, you know, we really like this conversation, but we'll come back to you when we have a lead, because, you know, you really need the terms before anyone is going to decide if they're in or out.
That's really interesting. So did you only target seed funds that are known to lead deals, or how did you kind of establish who to talk to and who not to?
Yeah, we just made a big list of, you know, all of the investors between, you know, we pitched people in Boston, New York, and San Francisco. We made a list of institutional seeds. You know, we were pretty narrowly focused on investors that do seeds as their main focus and actually don't do A's. That's another, you know, opinion that we had, which is occasionally larger funds that do A's and B's will write seed checks. But in our experience, there's some signaling risk there because it's sort of expected that that investor will then do your A later on. And if they don't, that's a big negative signal to other investors. And so we wanted to make sure that, you know, our seed investors, that's all they did as investors. It also helps down the line in terms of the amount of time that they can spend with you. You know, if you're a larger fund and you've put $100 million into one company and $2 million into another, like, guess who's going to get most of your time,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
and so by sticking with an institutional seed investor, you know, you sort of know that you are top of mind for them.
Yeah, that is all very logical. It makes a lot of sense. Were you actively identifying people who led deals? And if so, how did you identify people who were usually the leading deals?
So, you know, we made our list of investors. Certainly, there are investors with theses in areas. So in our case, you know, mobile, developer tools, infrastructure, AI, of course. But to be quite honest, a lot of VCs will put theses on their websites. And the truth is, they're in the business to make money, and they'll take a good deal if it comes their way. So, you know, don't not talk to an investor simply because their website says that they're in a space that you're not in. You know, in most cases, they're looking for a good deal, and they'll talk to you regardless. But so we made this list. We went through each of the firms that we were interested in and found partners by looking at their bios, their backgrounds, the previous deals that they had led according to either Crunchbase or their websites. And then, you know, it was just about finding a warm introduction.
Great, great. How many do you think you talked to over the course? How many firms were in your funnel?
A lot. So between the two companies, I haven't actually done the math to split them out. But again, you know, we were raising for one company and then pivoted, raised a few months later, probably 50, I would say. I mean, it was a good chunk of investors. The second time around, based on our experience the first time, we kind of knew who to target better. So it was fewer companies or fewer firms the second time around, but it was a lot.
Did you go for the ones you pitched for your first company, did you go back to those same guys and say, hey, we've pivoted, we've got a new thing, hear our story again? Because I find that's often hard for founders to go back to someone that basically told them no previously.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you have a problem with getting told no, you're probably not going to have a lot of fun in the startup game to begin with. But, you know, in our case, it was actually, you know, almost entirely positive. You know, we certainly have to have your story straight, and you should know that, like, the investor might have some questions for you, right? On the one hand, you know, they might be a little bit worried that, hey, you were working on an idea for a year and then you gave up on it, you know, or if they give you money, are you going to be committed? But on the other hand, which is, you know, the story that we told, which was true, was, you know, we had been doing this for a year. And my co-founder and I, you know, had a very frank conversation where we looked at each other and sort of said, okay, you know, we like working with each other. We think that we're a good team. We've already been through the crucible, you know, once, and we're willing to jump back into the flames and, you know, try this again with a different idea. And most of the VCs that we talked to, like, thought that was great, you know, and we're like, wow, like, this team is really committed to making something work. And so we didn't have any problem going back to people.
How much time was there between pitching the first company and when you kind of came back with 2.0?
I would say about 3 months.
Okay. Not that long. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, great. So ENIAC is lead and Uncorked is a co-lead or
they wrote another large check, yeah.
Gotcha. Did you how did you pick ENIAC as a lead? I've heard of them. I don't know them too well, but I'm more familiar with ex-SoftTech Uncork folks.
Yeah.
How did you pick them, or was it a competitive process that you ran, and did you have, you know, kind of a competition for the deal, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so there's actually a bit of a funny story. Vic Singh is our partner there, and he was actually the first investor we pitched Fritz. Very first meeting, it was actually a game time decision on the way to the meeting as to whether or not to pitch them the previous business or the new one. And you know, at that point, we had already been thinking about this new idea for a few months, and it was a warm intro through a friend. And we just decided, you know, let's do it. Let's see how this goes. And we had, like, the very first version of this deck. And I'm sure it was a terrible pitch. But at the end of the day, Vic had decided that a while back that he needed to understand, you know, more about the entrepreneur side of the table. And so he had actually started a company.
Yeah.
And it turned out that company had exactly the problem that we were trying to solve. And so it really just clicked right away with him, and they ended up leading the round after all was said and done. I mean, we still ran a very formal process around that, but, you know, just throughout that entire time, it just became clear that, like, not only does ENIAC have a really, really good reputation, but, you know, having an investor that was also a founder and, like, understands the pain that you're trying to solve, like, it just made it really obvious.
That's great. Okay, so you get them, you land them in the deal, and then did you go about trying to find a, I don't know what you call it, another, if you're not calling a co-lead, another large institutional fund to come in?
We syndicated the deal. And in that case, you'll read a lot of blog articles about this, and it's certainly true in my experience, is that all the dynamics flip after, right? Like, getting the one yes for the lead is, you know, the hardest thing you'll ever go through, and then the rest falls into place, you know, relatively quickly. We did a ton of pitches afterwards, but, you know, after a firm is in, all the firms have relationships with each other, and they have, you know, friendly firms that they like doing deals with, they have firms they don't like doing deals with, and so, you know, we got synced up with a lot of them through our lead investor. Now, I would not recommend taking intros from, or I'd be careful taking intros from investors as you go out and try to network and get into different partners, because again, there's like a signaling risk. If an investor passes you from their firm to another firm without investing, like, that can raise some red flags.
You mean if investor makes the intro, but they haven't, not ENIAC, some other investor makes an intro that didn't commit?
Yeah, exactly. But if that investor that's making the intro is a lead and they're already putting down a big check, that's a very different signal, right? And so the syndicate actually fell into place pretty quickly. I mean, you still have to go through all the meetings and the pitches, but it's a very different conversation. It moves a lot faster after that initial yes is there.
Yeah, no, that's great. Did you ever, kind of a riff on that signaling risk, were you ever worried that ENIAC would make an introduction to another firm, you go pitch that firm, they pass, and somehow that would signal back to ENIAC? Was there any of that kind of risk?
No, I mean, I'll give ENIAC all the credit here. They have a lot of conviction, and when they make a decision, they're in. And, you know, we've seen that, like, multiple times in you know, even just a few months that we've worked with them. And so I never felt worried about that.
That's great. Let's see here. And then, so getting these syndicates, did the syndicates pick up just the last, you know, 30% of the round, the AngelList syndicate, or more than that? Like, how much, this is a question a lot of people have, like, how much can you really lean on syndicates to raise?
I mean, you can lean on them as much as you have time, right? Yeah. And so I don't think anyone would have cared the fraction of the round. It's just a matter of how much time you have. Like, again, you know, in my experience, pitching a syndicate for a 50, 100, 150, 200K check is as much work and effort as pitching a lead investor and going through two or three partner meetings. You know, maybe the boardroom's a little bit bigger and it feels a little bit scarier, but in terms of actual, like, hours, it's about the same time. And so, you know, I think it's totally reasonable for people to, you know, do an entire round full of smaller checks. It's just now you've got to manage all of those investors and manage all of those meetings, and scheduling is really difficult. But I don't think the actual check sizes really matter.
Okay. Bit of a tangent. When you got ENIAC as a lead, what kind of metrics did the company have? It sounds like you were almost conceptual, correct? Pitch deck and a neat idea, or were you?
We had a prototype. We had working technology, and we also had a team. So we had already identified a team of three other engineers that we had worked with in the past. I mean, they were ready to go, just sort of waiting until we could pay them. And so, you know, I think the fact that really strong founding team, along with an engineering team that was just ready to hit the ground running immediately with a working prototype, was enough to put it over the edge. Obviously, though, if you're a founder, wait as long as you possibly can in terms of traction. I mean, if things are working correctly, your company gets more and more valuable every single day. But, you know, in our case, though, we had been bootstrapping for long enough, and we sort of, you know, saw where the market was headed, and we really wanted to get out in front of it.
Yeah, that's great. This is a common question. Like, how do you raise money if you don't have revenue or if you're pre-product? And I think you've answered a lot of that already. Was this team they weren't actually on board, but they were kind of conditionally on board. Once you raise money, they would come on. Is that a true statement? And was it a, like, contractual thing where you actually could go to investors and say, these guys have committed, it's, you know, or is it more, they said they'll come in when we have money?
It was more of the latter, but, you know, in a few cases, we had been, paying them as contractors to help build out the prototype. So, like, there was some evidence there that, you know, things were fine. And also, you know, my co-founder, he's been building and running engineering teams in Boston for, like, over a decade at this point. And, you know, it's pretty clear that, like, he can hire a team and I can do a bunch of deep learning stuff. You know, like, that part kind of came through with our resumes.
You know, so you've done something pretty remarkable, raised money for a very early, you know, prototype stage business. How much of it do you think was the market you're in, which is a pretty hot space, at least has been for the past several months? Do you think some of these investors were?
Yeah. I definitely think, it's a hot market. I happen to believe in all these technology trends. I mean, if you look at what's happening today, you've got 39 million, according to the last poll estimate I've seen, like smart speakers out in people's living rooms right now. Those are running neural networks on a little chip to hear, you know, listen for words like Google, Alexa, you know, whatnot. Like, this stuff is already sort of deployed in mass, by companies that could make an investment and hire 2,000 PhDs. Large companies like Snapchat have purchased this tech for hundreds of millions of dollars. And Apple had taken all of this money to develop the A11 processor, which has a special neural engine in it just for processing neural networks. They had done the effort of adding CoreML to their developer kit. And so the writing was sort of on the wall in terms of other people, large companies have already staked a lot on this trend actually coming to fruition. And so I think that was enough for investors to look at and say, you know, this market's definitely going to be there. People have already spent all of this money on it, and it's just a matter of getting there first.
Cool. No, that's good. It's funny, though, how I've been around just the venture world a while, and it's funny how VCs relabel themselves, rebrand themselves. They're suddenly, you know, AI venture firm or machine learning or whatever the kind of hot thing of the day is. It's amazing how quickly the chameleon changes their color sometimes.
That's the nature of the game. We have a .ai domain name, and I'm interested to see what the next one will be. Is .io before, .ly? We'll see.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Good stuff. Let's see here. Any tricky parts about hardest parts about raising capital? Anything get a little unnerving in the negotiations or diligence process? Or, you know, what was the hardest part about raising that round?
The hardest part is getting a yes, like getting the lead in place. Diligence in our case was fairly straightforward. ENIAC is a nice reputable firm, and the terms were clean. No one's trying to pull anything over anybody else. It was a very fair, respectful negotiation. Like that stuff was easy in the context of getting the first yes. And I think to get there, there's a lot of work that needs to go into running the process and really like honing your story. I mean, we went through probably, we labeled all of them. So I think we were up to like 14, version 14 or 15 of our pitch deck for each of the companies that we tried to raise for. I mean, you need to be going into every meeting. It was great to go in the co-founder. He would write down all the questions we got. We would debrief afterwards and change the deck every time and make a new version of that. As an entrepreneur, like you need to be doing that constantly, and it takes a ton of work. The last thing on that, like the story that you're really trying to craft is, I forget who said this, but there's a story you tell your investors, the story you tell your employees, and the story you tell your customers. And it's not about like lying to anyone. It's just about sort of understanding what they need and what they're looking for. And I thought that I understood all of the incentives involved with venture capital and power law returns and all that stuff. But it wasn't until I was, you know, really in it and sort of trying to convince an investor to say yes that I fully like understood exactly what that means and started to understand why they would make a decision the way that they would or why they would ask a question and how I should answer those things. And so I think, you know, I would encourage founders to really try to understand the VC's business and use that to present your business in the best possible light to them.
Yeah, that's good. That's good advice. Well, I will say I have you beat though. When I raised our seed round, I was on version number 42 of our pitch deck by the end of it. But yeah, I totally agree with that advice of just constantly improving your story. And, you know, you get a lot of high velocity feedback when you're pitching and just incorporating that. That's great. Did you get just out of curiosity, because we raised money from a New York VC and we got the East Coast term sheet, which is a long term sheet. Did you get a West Coast or East Coast term sheet from?
I think it was a West Coast term sheet.
Good for you.
Yeah. It was a pretty straightforward process. Yeah. That's good lawyers though. I mean, they're not cheap, but you'll be glad you did.
Yeah. Very good. This is great. Any thoughts on like, general, you know, capital strategy for the future? I don't know if you have competitors in the space that have raised money. Do you anticipate having to raise a lot of funding, or will you keep this as lean and mean as possible, or have you maybe not even crossed that thought process?
You know, so we raised our round to get us through 12 to 18 months, and that's what we're working through right now. So we're right at the beginning of that. You know, we will obviously look to take on more capital if it makes sense, but the goal is to get to a place and raise when we can actually efficiently deploy that capital, right? And we have a plan to get there. We're working on it. But you know, that's the best time to raise, I think, is when you feel like you can actually deploy it, and not just when there's a timeline or, you know, hopefully you don't run out of money before that happens. But
are you thinking in terms of like when you have a certain level of customer traction, maybe you'll, you know, go raise money, or when you're ready to deploy it? What does that mean?
So, you know, when you have so much traffic that you've got to get other engineers in there to make sure that everything stays up and running, when you have so many requests for features that, you know, the backlog just can't get trimmed down fast enough, you know, those, or when you have a marketing channel that's working so well that every dollar you spend is giving you back $3, $4, or $5 in return, you know, those are clearly cases where you should be throwing gasoline on the fire and ramping up. But you know, it's until then, be as lean as possible and keep your burn down as low as possible, and you know, try to find that product market fit.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. This is great. So last question, what one piece of advice would you give yourself if you were doing it all over again? Anything?
Oh, that's a good question. Don't try to raise money in the summer. and investors will tell you that too, because they're constantly answering your emails while they're on vacation. But the summer, it will take you longer to raise money. I mean, maybe it's just a Boston thing and everyone's out enjoying the nice weather, but it is noticeably harder to track down people for meetings and whatnot in July and August.
That's interesting. What month did you end up raising? You said you just announced it in January. When did you?
Like September. So okay. we started all these conversations though in June and July, and so you know we've slogged through the pain, but yeah, it was at one point I was like, I'm gonna rent a boat and just go to Nantucket and like find all these all these VCs and pitch them there.
That would be an interesting strategy. That might make sense. That's good. That's good. Great. Any if people want to check you out, it's just fritz.ai, right?
Yep, fritz.ai. You can sign up for early access. We also have a community publication called Heartbeat. So if you go to heartbeat.fritz.ai, we post technical guides, spotlights, you know, anything to do with the intersection of machine learning and mobile development. We've got a great contributor program, so we will pay you to write a great post, a guide for other developers to get started with this stuff. So heartbeat.fritz.ai or fritz.ai, learn more about it.
Is there any story to the name Fritz? My great-great-great-grandpa from Germany was Friedrich and nicknamed Fritz. What's the where'd you come upon Fritz?
It was a five-letter domain name that we could easily get, and there's definitely an aspect of our tool which helps you figure out what's wrong with your machine learning algorithms when they're out on hundreds of millions of devices, and so hopefully it's easy for people to remember, and we'll make sure your app is not on the Fritz.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, on the Fritz, of course. Yes, good. Good stuff. All right, Jameson, I appreciate your time. Thanks, and I wish you continued success with Fritz.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Bye.